You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
North Atlantic Treaty Naval and Air Forces are put through rigid tests in the Mediterranean during one of the most extensive manoeuvres of its five-year-old existence.
NATO is building its largest presence of soldiers and military hardware on Russia's border since the Cold War. Is it prudent or provocative? And we'll be discussing Canada's newly brokered trade deal with the European Union, which looks set to be approved after months of negotiations. Also ahead...
Very pleased to see that the economy is still resilient. That tells us that we go into the period of negotiation for our exit from the EU from a position of strength with the economy doing very well.
Why does the UK economy seem surprisingly buoyant following the public's vote to leave the EU bloc back in June? And we'll be finding out why one of the world's smallest countries is offering incentives to lure its expats home. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are Matthew Green, who was the FT's correspondent in West Africa, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University of London. A warm welcome both. Great to have you with us on the programme. Let's start. NATO members are sending a huge number of soldiers and military hardware to Russia's borders in what's thought to be its biggest deployment since the Cold War. Hence us playing that pleasing old-school Pathé footage at the top. It comes, though, as Russia's aircraft carrier, Admiral Kuznetsov, continues to make its way to the Syrian coast. But is the best way of confronting Russia with a show of strength and unity, or is this provocation? Matthew Green, perhaps I'll come to you. There's been a lot of talk about, you know, a new Cold War, and we haven't seen hostilities or movements like this since then. Is that unhelpful rhetoric, or do you think, in a way... it does inform some of what we're seeing.
Well, that was the phrase that was used by the Russian Prime Minister a few months ago at a security conference in Munich. He did talk about the advent of a new Cold War. And it's pretty clear, if you zoom out and look at the big picture, that things are very serious. We've seen the Russian aggression in Crimea in 2014. We've seen Russia acting very boldly in Syria to prop up President Assad. And they've been conducting huge exercises on the border of Europe, not to mention all the other irritants from Russian warplanes buzzing British airspace and the hacking by Russian activists of emails related to the US election campaign. So the picture, I think, is very serious indeed.
Oscar, do you think sometimes there's a risk? We often talk about the kind of proxy conflicts that are being played out around the world, and Syria is obviously one such ground involving Russia and several other parties. Does that sometimes distract us from the fact that, you know, as Matthew says there, right on the borders of Russia, there are movements which look like old school, the kind of old school jockeying which we saw right through until what, you know, the mid to late 1980s?
Matt is absolutely right. We are in the middle of a new Cold War. But actually, if we want to tell the whole story, we should not only despair of the role of Russia in Aleppo and or in Crimea, we should also question the role of NATO allies in supporting the Saudi coalition in Yemen, for instance, and why our own MPs defeated yesterday a motion to consider precisely that point. The issue there is that if we really want to be serious about Russia, and if we want to be heard around the world, then we cannot allow this sort of double standards. We're still selling arms to Saudi Arabia, which might be used against civilians in the city of Hodeida, where children are dying of hunger and so on and so forth. So this is the point. If at best the NATO move will serve as a deterrent, then the leader of NATO was being disingenuous at the very least when he told us that the aim of this was neither to confront Russia nor to initiate some sort of Cold War. Deterrence was, in fact, the logic of the Cold War. But I'm also afraid that this might turn out to be also, you know, some kind of empty posturing.
Matt, on that point, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? We mentioned these proxy disputes. We understand that politicians and politics more broadly is governed by expediency, because that's the reality, especially in, you know, set terms of office. Is it the case that until we get a bit more transparency or honesty about that, especially with some of the examples that Oscar has given us, that causes a problem, whether it's NATO or member nations making pronouncements on this? Their credibility, I guess, can be called into question because of that.
Yeah, well, we're looking here at the hardest of realpolitik, aren't we? Russia has not hesitated to use its hard power, and it's been getting results by doing so. I think the issue with NATO is that for many years, the US has been somewhat ambivalent over the alliance. We've seen the sort of rhetoric that's been coming out from the Trump campaign about NATO allies having to pay for their defence and so on. At the same time, defence spending in NATO countries has been pretty low. I'm certainly not a militarist, but it's fairly obvious that the Russians do feel very confident. And it's not at all clear that we actually have the sort of unchallenged superiority that we would have done in the 80s or 90s. The Russians have been spending hundreds of billions of pounds on upgrading their military. They're able to deny, they've got very sophisticated air defense systems that are able to deny access to large swathes of Eastern Europe and the Middle East to US aircraft. I mean, you played the Pathé news clip, but things have moved on. The Russians are a very different military to the ones that the military they were a few years ago. And, you know, this isn't my area of expertise, but reading in on it, it's pretty worrying.
And Oscar, let me ask you about, it's interesting looking at, for example, what Jens Stoltenberg has to say about this when pushed about, you know, if battle-ready troops are moved, you know, closer to Russia's borders, whether that remains a deterrence, whether that's an act of aggression. And he says NATO is always defensive and proportionate. Of course, he would say that. Do you think NATO is those two things?
Look, it's complicated to read his words and not think, ooh, double speak. Because immediately you think, well, if this is not a confrontation and the idea is not to initiate some sort of Cold War logic, then to also speak of deterrence, and that's, you know, the best case you would make for this kind of move, becomes a contradiction in terms. But, you know, we just heard a very interesting point. Things have moved on. Which leads me to wonder whether this move, necessary as it might seem, may ultimately be some kind of empty posturing. Because, I mean, the more weapons you throw, the more airplanes and so on, I mean, we all know that ultimately we cannot really square up, because the consequences would be catastrophic. So either some kind of new Cold War, or else we get serious, we get real, we abandon double standards, and then we do what needs to be done. For instance, in the case of Syria, we know we need to talk, and we need more diplomacy there.
And I guess, Matt, you still get a situation where maybe NATO then, perhaps because there's a bit of a confusion or uncertainty about where it should be directing its purpose. For example, there was pressure leveraged on Spain, wasn't there, to withdraw this offer to refuel Russian vessels that were on their way to Syria. Now, we don't know whether that was NATO's pushing that prompted that withdrawal, or whether it was governed by domestic politics within Spain. Do you think that's an example of NATO not really being sure of where to try and assert itself?
Well, again, with the caveat that in an ideal world, we wouldn't even need to be having this conversation. Looking at it through the prism of pure hard power, Russia is running rings around NATO at the moment. It's doing what it basically pleases in Syria, completely unopposed, and has tipped the balance in that war in favor of its proxy, its client. We've seen what's happened in Ukraine, where NATO has been powerless to do anything. And there's a huge amount of anxiety in the Baltic states that they could be the next dominoes to fall. And that there's similar anxiety in a country like Poland. So this is a very real issue for Eastern Europe. And I think you see some of the reporting in the British papers about how we're putting pressure on Russia by sending 450 members of the Royal Anglians. Yeah. I mean, there was a report that was leaked a few weeks ago that said the British army would be rolled up in a few days by the Russians, because they're good and they're big and they're highly sophisticated. And we are not in a position to be putting pressure on them. It's of course, at this stage, it's a symbolic act. It's a game of chess. It's a strategic, symbolic posturing that we're seeing. But we have to hope that this is handled very subtly and that it doesn't escalate.
Which is why it needs to be handled diplomatically. I mean, there is no military solution for this because, you know, the minute this gets serious, either our armies get rolled over, or else we're also, you know, inviting into the conversation the Chinese, and then things get even worse.
Or Russia turns off its gas exports to Germany,
exactly.
And then see what happens. See how quickly NATO will start to crack. So we take our post-war security settlement very much for granted. I don't think we can be too complacent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. We need a settlement.
Yeah.
We don't
yeah.
have a settlement yeah. as such. And that requires yeah. negotiation. And there, the United Nations, all those, the ways
can
of
we
doing
really
so
negotiate with Putin, though? He seems to
of
be
course.
He's playing a hardball.
Of course. And we do as well. That's precisely how the game is played. But we know we can because, for instance, we have made achievements in the case of Syria. Small, though they may be, the people who have spent a lot of time trying to negotiate and to keep Lavrov and Kerry on the table know that can
some
be done.
Some incremental gains can be made. Well, speaking of tricky negotiations and the importance of diplomacy, let's turn to Brexit, usually followed by the word uncertainty, certainly in the thousands upon thousands upon thousands of newspaper columns that have been written over the past, 4 months or so. Surprisingly, then, it appears Britain's economy is holding up pretty well. Official data released today showed that the UK's economic performance has continued on an upward trajectory since the public vote to leave the EU. We heard from Philip Hammond. I would slightly facetiously say, well, it hasn't happened yet, and that's why we're not seeing it. Am I missing?
I don't think you're being facetious at all. I think you're merely applying rationality and logic, which is something that is rarely used
in this
debate.
That these days.
Very much missed.
Exactly.
These days.
I mean, obviously, I'm in the Ramona camp, so I'm disappointed to see any good news emerging in the wake of Brexit. But yes, you're absolutely right. Brexit hasn't happened yet. And the real impact that we have to be watching, of course, is from the historic weakness that has developed in the pound. It hasn't had time yet to feed through into the real economy in terms of the elevated cost of imports, such as fuel and raw materials. But we will see that, and that is going to have a knock-on effect. So I think the crowing from the Brexiteers that, everything's going to be fine, is very much premature.
And that's an important point, isn't it, Oscar, about the currency? The pound has been this extraordinary buffer so far. It seems to have soaked up so much of the shock. And indeed, the short-term benefit, certainly for big exporters, FTSE 100 types, has been actively beneficial, which has added to this, I don't know, it seems to me, illusory picture of, everything's fine.
We shouldn't take this as good news because it isn't good news. Even if you take, if you believe the actual narrative, 0.5% is worse than what we had in the previous quarter, 0.7%. And we're still in the zeros. I mean, this is a sluggish growth at best. And actually, the worst is yet to come, because indeed a weaker pound will contribute to, is already contributing to higher import prices, and that in turn contributes to a sharp rise in inflation. And that is going to hit us, consumers, middle-class people, and particularly those for whom the economy is not working, those who are in previous months have received 1,100,000 parcels of food from food banks. That number is the one that I would put, on my headlines, because it is shameful for a country such as the United Kingdom.
And I think it's also worth drilling down into the figures a little more carefully, because looking at construction, that has actually contracted by 1.5%, which is a really significant slowdown. And obviously construction is a leading indicator, a forward-looking indicator, because it it involves much more solid and longer term investment decisions. So if that is the proverbial canary in the coal mine, then we could have a real problem that the bigger number is disguised.
It could have tweeted its last already.
Absolutely. Also, manufacturing is still struggling. And actually, you know, if you take the industry that seemed to have contributed to this as sluggish growth, the film industry, for instance. As John Kampfner, the head of the Creative Industries Federation, will tell you, all of the creative industries in the country, film being included, are suffering, and they're very, very concerned about the effects of Brexit. Actually, the British film industry is the one who's telling us the real story. Ken Loach's film, for instance, about how real people are struggling in this very uncertain climate.
And I guess it's in certain creative industries where that sort of brain drain fear could be activated most quickly, because people are used to their ability to travel and work freely. And many of the creative classes who, anecdotally, we speak to say, I don't know, we might not stick around.
It's just terrible. We're condemning ourselves to not having another Carlos Acosta in Bali. All of the people who have contributed to the creativity that has made a city like London what it is. There aren't good news here.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about trade deals, because obviously one of the kind of will they, won't they, is one of the great uncertainties is what we can agree with Brussels, with all of the other EU member states. And it's been interesting watching the move this week around CETA, this deal between the European Union, of course, and Canada, which it seems now Belgium's quite varied political leadership has reached some sort of consensus to support this. Matt, To me, what I think is, it's funny, if you can't get CETA, which was, you know, a long-standing arrangement, broadly agreed upon, we couldn't get that past essentially the Walloons, what chance of getting a semblance of a UK-EU deal past all these angry EU member states?
Well, I think it's a very pertinent question. And as you say, angry member states. All of these countries who are committed to the preservation of the EU have every incentive to extract the most punishing possible terms from us in any negotiations.
Remember, the deal that Cameron struck whilst we were still a paid-up member wasn't exactly attractive.
Exactly. And I think it's worth remembering that almost 50% of our British exports go to EU countries. And the EU, in return, exports about 8 or 10% of exports to us. So we're already starting from a disadvantageous negotiating position. And as you say, the wrangling over CETA has demonstrated just how complicated, fraught, and enervating trade negotiations are. So the idea that this is going to be wrapped up in 2 years is obviously a fantasy.
Oscar, on this CETA deal, though, it's interesting. The kind of idea of trade deals, and this one as well, has been thrown into sharp focus. It's been a topic, I guess, if we look at the Trump-Clinton campaigning,
yes,
we talked about trade a lot more than in previous iterations. Do you look around the world and say, well, hang on, look, there are plenty of big trade deals that are, you know, fit for purpose, that work very well, that show the way? Or do you look around and say, well, actually, maybe it is that we are in a generation where people are starting to question these things?
Look, 10 years ago, everybody wanted a trade deal. Now, nobody wants one. Neither Trump nor Clinton. They're terribly unpopular. Actually, in terms of what good this is going to do to Canada, for instance. Well, I called my sister who lives in Alberta, and immediately she tells me, well, you know, the mood here is still terrible. So to add to the complexities of negotiating a trade deal in the context of in a context in which trade deals are politically unpopular and will be more unpopular, particularly here in Europe, because as the Front National rises in France and similar parties, the populist right parties do so in Germany, we hear more and more the idea that trade deals take jobs elsewhere. Mm. There is a point there. And in that environment, it will be very difficult to sell this kind of deal to European countries. And there are 25 of them, and they have every single incentive to squeeze the UK as hard as they can.
Matt, maybe just finally on this, it's interesting what Oscar mentioned there about, you know, Hillary Clinton certainly not looking like an advocate even of trade deals or actively questioning them. And this, we should remember, is, you know, a Democrat candidate who we would traditionally have expected to hear something rather more enthusiastic. And again, this other narrative, the rise of, you know, populists, the nationalists around the world, sadly, is that why these things are under pressure? Or, you know, should we start to ask whether the, you know, the time has come for these big global deals?
Well, they're obviously a lot more contentious than they were a few years ago when nobody paid much attention to them. And they've obviously become a target for campaigners now who are very concerned about many provisions in these agreements, particularly the idea that companies can have rights to sue governments over rules they make. Although in Britain, there are many laws that allow that to happen already as it happens. But yes, absolutely. These are no longer uncontested. And I think, I mean, going to Hillary Clinton, obviously she's fighting an election and she's very careful about what she says in public. We know in private she sings a very different tune as her speeches to Goldman Sachs and others have revealed. I don't think that we're at the stage yet where we're going to see a global retreat from the sort of liberal, neoliberal economic model, even though it has obviously brought us to the brink of planetary disaster. But that's probably another conversation. The reality is it is going to, the forces behind it, the corporate forces, are still extremely strong. And I don't see this tide turning.
But even in the case of America, I mean, there are indications that the tide is beginning to turn. It is the case that Clinton in private sings a different tune, but others in her party, not just Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren and others are making, you know, intelligent and consistent calls for corporate money and so on and so forth to, you know, be taken out of their dominant political position.
The insights of Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Matthew Green, my guests today on Midori House. Coming up next on the programme is Venezuela's embattled administration on the verge of falling from power.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I'd like to tell you all about a very special edition of The Foreign Desk coming up next month. For the first time, The Foreign Desk will be recorded live in front of an audience here at Midori House in London. We'll have a fantastic panel of guests, all experts in their field, and we've got a topic that will provide plenty for them to get their teeth into.
It's not about us so much as it is about you and your families and the kind of country and future you want.
Taking place a week after the US presidential vote, we'll ask what the election of President Clinton or President Trump means for the rest of the world.
We are going to enforce all trade violations against any country that cheats.
So we have a topic, we have guests. All that's missing is you. If you'd like to be in the audience, head to monocle.com to buy your ticket today. That's The Foreign Desk Live with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Tuesday, the 15th of November at 1900.
You're listening to Midori House. Now, a policeman's been killed and dozens injured after a huge anti-government protest in Venezuela. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of Caracas in an attempt to force a vote that could oust President Nicolas Maduro from power. So could his government be about to fall? Still with me are Matthew Green and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. And Oscar, that's a question I think I've possibly posed to you before even on this programme. Are we inching towards, I don't know, a more significant change perhaps?
It's difficult to tell because, on the one hand, it is the case that the Maduro administration has run out of its political capital and is very unpopular for good reasons. I mean, people at very grassroots levels are suffering. And yet, the mostly right-wing opposition is trying to use pretty much the same expedient that was used by the Brazilian opposition in order to rid themselves of President Dilma Rousseff. And that's certainly not a good thing. So although they condemn and accuse the government of becoming authoritarian and or perhaps even a dictatorship, that means that the government can in turn tell them, but what you're trying is also a coup. And in the middle of this, the problem is that neither the government nor the right-wing opposition are doing nothing to solve the concrete needs of people in the streets who are hungry, who are really struggling to get cover for their basic needs.
And Matt, I guess that's the worry here, is we can talk about the political manoeuvrings, but this has the hallmarks of the kinds of examples we've seen before over the last couple of decades, where, exactly as Oscar says, the people are left behind. And, you know, people talked about Venezuela, you know, being a sort of basket case economy. We know about some of the very immediate challenges that Oscar's talked about. I mean, should we be worried that this gets a lot worse before it gets any better?
Well, it does sound like it's got pretty worse already, doesn't it? And the reports of the lack of medicine in hospitals are really shocking, and even the food shortages. But Oscar, you were there recently, right? I was just curious to hear what you felt about the atmosphere.
It is true that people are being hit the hardest, and people who shouldn't be, precisely because these were the people who were the strongest sympathizers of the Chavismo. Now, one has to make a distinction here, and it is complicated. Chavismo is not unpopular. Just yesterday and the day before, we saw mobilizations in support of Chavismo. But the Maduro government, the Maduro version of Chavismo, is very unpopular. And there are sectors of the left who used to support Chavez and Chavismo who are now saying, look, let's allow for a constitutional exit. And that's the way to go. That might be the referendum that to call Maduro. And then the beginning of a transitional period. Piece of good news we had last week. The Vatican has been trying to broker a deal between the opposition and the government. And there are signs that that can happen. Part of the problem is that the opposition are also very complicated. They don't seem to want to negotiate. Among other reasons, and I learned this while being there and also from people who are still there, of course, if they get to power, then they will have to solve the situation. And they don't have...
No one has an answer to the really big...
No, because the problem here is that the Venezuelan economy has been for almost 100 years totally dependent on oil. Mm. And that's gone. Mm. So it's a sort of existential change, and nobody's accepting that in the country.
Let's move on, because before the end of the show, I did want to talk about... place we maybe have overlooked here at Monocle before. We often talk about the best places to live, but we may not have told you about the South Pacific island of Niue. It's one of the world's smallest countries, but it's declared itself debt-free. If that's not good enough, it said it will be spending all the extra money as a result of said debt-freeness on increasing pensions. Oscar, this is a good news story, isn't it? If you're thinking of having a baby, apparently there's a big cash payout if you're in Niue. This is going to coax back the expats. I don't know, maybe boost the population of other interested parties.
Actually, I had a baby a year and a half ago, so I'm ready to move.
you missed out on a $1,500 cash payment.
Let's on a more serious note, these are examples to follow. Of course, there are, very specific conditions here, a very small population, and so on and so forth. But let us remember that in the previous decade and a half, big countries such as Brazil, for instance, also paid their external debt. Which is why the economic situation in Brazil has nothing to do with, mismanagement of the economy, but rather with serious political corruption and so on. Again, if you look at what Brazil did with that money, well, it lifted out of poverty during the Lula administration almost 40 million people. So these are examples that can be followed. And there are plenty of lessons to learn from here. Also, the weather is just brilliant.
Well, I was going to say, Matt, I don't know if on your extensive global travels you've had the opportunity to visit...
Not yet.
Anyway, but it could be
happening. It may be next on my list.
But what about this broader point that Oscar makes? We talked often about... cancelling debt for other nations, some of these basket case economies, maybe this could have helped them out if it had happened a decade or two earlier. Do you think there are some serious lessons here? Or should
Well, we should bear in mind the population of Niue is 2,000 people.
It's modest.
It's pretty small. You said that it's one of the world's smallest countries. Is there anywhere actually smaller? I mean,
well, don't put me on the spot, Matt, but there could be one or two.
I'm curious, but it does sound like an idyllic place. But we saw in Africa in the 90s debt cancellation movements, which were very effective and helped to unleash much faster growth in a lot of countries, which has seen, I mean, somewhat perhaps overtalked, but there is a growing African middle class now, and a lot of people have escaped poverty in Africa, partly as a result of debt relief. So it's obviously a key tool for helping countries that are struggling.
But something to bear in mind. Oscar, I'm afraid there we must leave it. We're out of time. What fun we've been having. Matthew and Oscar, thank you both very much for being with us here on Midori House today. It's all we've got time for. Thanks to our producer, Rhys James, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Seller, and our studio manager, Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music coming for you next at 1900. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And we'll have more on all the big news stories of the day, and maybe some of the smaller ones too, on the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. Do join us then. But from me, Tom Edwards, and all the rest of the Thursday team, thank you very much for tuning in.